At this time, it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker for tonight, Dave from San Diego. Come on up, buddy. Let's do this.
Thank you. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Appreciate it. My name's Dave. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Dave.
Good to be here. Thanks to Pioneers. John, thanks for inviting me. The staff, and congratulations on the new building. That's great. That's, I know, but it's, if you say it's coming, it will be. So I've seen a lot of progress on this program over the years. And congratulations to the, was it Jacob, Feliciano, Travis, Cliff, and Lenny on the celebrations. You know, that's celebration of life over death, and that's great. So it's an AA meeting, I understand, from what says on the wall and what it said on the, you know, what we talk about. So I'm going to, and I probably could have just told Bill, go to the doctor's opinion, read something for me. He would have done it, and I wouldn't have needed the book, but I didn't know if he was available. But I just want to read something that really applied to me and maybe to some of you as well. In the doctor's opinion, he says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. The sensation is so elusive that while they admit it is injurious, they cannot, after a time, differentiate the true from the false. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience that sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks, drinks which they see others taking with impunity. And leave it there for a minute and tell you that, you know, I drank at some point because I liked the effect of alcohol. You know, I liked it a lot. I also liked the effect of certain narcotics and pills. I liked that a lot. I liked nicotine. You know, that had a nice effect. I liked nicotine as well. I liked to gamble. I liked the effect that gambling had. I liked when I won, and, you know, I kind of cringed when I lost, but I came back for more. You know, I liked to spend money, especially with somebody else's money. I liked that even better. But if it was my money, I tended to overspend. So I did all of those things and others because they made me feel good. They made me change the way I felt. They made me forget about whatever might be bothering me at the time. But the funny thing is, out of all that stuff, what happened to me was that I could tamp down some things. I could leave some things on the side of the road for a while, but I couldn't leave alcohol alone. It says later in the book that, you know, we're men and women that have lost the ability to control our drinking, that where we used to enjoy it and found that to enjoy it, we couldn't control it any longer. And that's what happened to me, you know, that over a period of time, and it didn't happen overnight, but it happened over a series of overnights and overnights and overnights, I lost the ability to control my drinking. And again, when did it hit me? It hit me, I don't know when it hit me. I'll be quite honest with you. I'm not sure when it came to me that I was powerless over alcohol. The only thing that I knew for sure was that I needed to drink. Nothing would stop me from drinking. If I was down to my last $5, I wasn't going to gamble it. I wasn't going to buy drugs with it. I was going to look for alcohol because that was my solution. That was what did it for me. And there came a time when, as we talk about in this program, where a realization came to me that, as it says in the first step, that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. And for me, that date is and was March 13th, 1980. So I've been sober for quite a while. I've been sober for a lifetime for some people. You know, I celebrated 44 years in March. I didn't think I would make it to 40 years old, let alone to 44 years sober. You know, so the fact that I've done that and I'm still standing here on, you know, the end of June, what is it, 2024? Some, you know, how can it be 2024? You know, it's 1980, a couple of days ago, it seems to me many times. My point is that you know, that we all took a journey to get here. You know, we started somewhere along the line and something happened and things changed and then they changed again and here we are. So what I'm going to try to do is to tell you a little bit about that journey and what happened to me and why it happened and how maybe it could help somebody along the line. You know, I didn't, well, there's a couple of reasons. You know, never sure why I drank. I was born, I was raised in the Central Valley between Fresno and Bakersfield, small town called Visalia. Now, many people will tell you, no wonder you drank. You ever been to Fresno in July, for God's sake? You know, anybody would drink there. And it was, you know, it was back in the kind of Leave It to Beaver days. The doors were always open. People came and went as they wanted to. You know, the kids, we just out riding our bikes. And I think every dad had their own whistle, and they'd whistle for dinner time and, you know, pass it across the neighborhood, and everybody go home. The my folks didn't drink, or if they did, it was moderate. They didn't smoke. They weren't necessarily churchgoers. They just didn't drink, and they didn't smoke. And nor did many of the people in my family. I had the fortunate or unfortunate occasion to be the first born in my generation. So I was the first grandson. I was the first nephew. So I ruled the roost for the best part of 4 to 5 years. Now, some people would say that he was spoiled. You know, some of my relatives have told me that. I don't think so. I think it had a little bit more to do with entitlement. And, you know, I was a cute kid, and I had these things coming. Did that make me an alcoholic? You know, I don't know if it made me an alcoholic or not. That's, you know, wasn't really the point. But what it did was, you know, I just said the magic word, that entitlement, because, you know, my folks did, you know, we were middle-class people. But it seemed that I got every darn thing that I wanted or thought that I needed. You know, I had an uncle in the car business. He got me a car when I was 15 years old. Pardon me. And when I was 15 years old, when I was 15 and a half in California, you get a learner's permit. And back then, for you youngsters out there, you could drive if you had a licensed driver in your car. Again, I had the good fortune, or bad fortune, depending on how you want to look at it, for getting accelerated out of kindergarten. I thought it was because I was smart and could read. It turned out it was because I flunked nap. I couldn't nap, and apparently I bothered some of the girls in the class or something. So they put me in first grade because that teacher was a little more strict. So consequently, I was like a year ahead of myself and younger than most people I went to school with. So all my friends had licenses, but few of them had cars. So I, by virtue of having a car, whether they liked me or not, I was popular. You know, I mean, it was popular. And it was, what I say, Leave It to Beaver was like, I went brain dead. What's the movie? Anyway, Dragon Main Street. It'll come to me in a minute. Thank you. American, thank you. See, I'm not the only one of that generation. American Graffiti. And that's what it was like. You know, if you saw the movie, it was kind of like that. You know, we'd spend time going up and down Main Street, trying to pick up girls that didn't want to be picked up, weren't interested in us. We'd go to other towns and get in a little bit of trouble with guys over there because they didn't want us bothering their girls because they didn't want to go out with them either. And, you know, it was just, we'd race on the back streets. We'd drink when we could get something to drink. We found that a couple of places were fairly easy. One is, well, until they figured out the local country club. We didn't belong there, but we knew where the window was that we could get through into the storeroom where the booze was. The other place that worked was if we gave the guy who worked at Safeway $5, he'd slide a couple of cases of beer on the back on the dock, you know, and then lock the door, and we'd go around and pick him up. I don't know if anybody ever remembers Brown Derby beer. That was the cheapest beer that Safeway had or God ever made. Rumor was it was what was left over after they made, you know, real beer. When they cleaned the vats out, they made it Brown Derby. Did that make us sick? I don't know. It was probably that and a mix of peppermint schnapps or whatever we had that did the job. The point is, I liked the way it made me feel. You know, I liked the way it made me feel. And I found I could drink a lot. And I rarely got sick or too sick. You know, and I was the driver. Should mention one other small fact of life in that town at that time. My grandfather was chief of police. Now, he had been the chief of police. He was the chief of police up until I was, I think, in fifth or sixth grade, and then he went to work as a special investigator for the sheriff's department. But as a result of that, and my uncle being in the insurance business, and my dad being well-known, and my other uncle in the car business, people knew us. They knew the family. You know, I don't mind sharing it. My last name is Flutie because that's what they call me, the Flutie kid. And who's your dad? So I'd have to run down who my dad was and who the uncles were. So did I get in trouble? Yeah, I got in trouble. Did I get out of things? Yes and no. Two, mainly, probably did, because I'd get a warning. But what came with the warning was a call to my granddad. And then I have to go to my granddad's house. My granddad was he played semi-pro ball when he was young. And his hands were like a catcher's mitt. And I would walk in, he'd put a hand on my shoulder, and I'd just think, oh, God, don't squeeze, don't squeeze. Don't squeeze. I don't want to be left-handed the rest of my life. And we'd have a conversation, and, you know, I'd clean it up. I was sneaky. I was dishonest. I was all those things. At the same time, I was good in school. You know, school came easy. I was not particularly good at athletics. I was this tall when I was in the, I think, seventh grade. So, you know, go play basketball. I hated it. Didn't want to play. Couldn't jump. Couldn't shoot. Couldn't do any of those things, but I was tall, you know, so I was kind of like the stick in the middle of the court until some guy a couple of years older on the other team grabbed my, well, you know, whatever, come, you know, the thing that you wear into your gym shorts and gave me a wedgie that I'll never forget, lifted me about 3 feet off the ground. And I said, you know, that's it for that. So I took up tennis or golf or, you know, something like that where I didn't have to put up with that nonsense. By virtue of doing good in school, and I got good grades, and I was particularly kind of bragging a lot. I was good at, but I was luckily good at taking tests like the SAT and some of those. So I ended up with a university scholarship. So I went barely 17 years old because I was a year ahead, graduated from high school, went from a town that had, I think at that time just cracked 10,000 people. Remember the big sign going up in the city limits. And went to a university that had a click over 10,000 students at the time. So I had gone from being admittedly kind of a self-important, and some people would say little jerk in a small town or in a small pond, however you want to put it, to being a nobody in a big pond. And I was over my head real quickly. The other gift, if you call it, or maybe it's not a gift, is that I was a pretty good chameleon. If I saw what you did and people accepted it, I would do that. You know, if you looked a certain way, talked a certain way, dressed a certain way, I would kind of fall into that if I saw that you were, you know, it was working for you and you were popular. So that's what I did. Studied hard the first semester, in a kind of boarding house thing, had an older guy in the room that, you know, taught me how to, help me study and showed me how to do things, got good grades. Second semester, I joined a fraternity because I liked what they were doing. That was more social. And I said, well, I need to be part of that. And at being part of that, you know, that meant that keg parties and other things that happened were more prevalent than if you were living, you know, on the dark side of campus in a boarding house where you didn't have any social life. I remember, God, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. They had a beer machine. Had a beer machine, you know, it was a Coke machine, but it turned into a beer machine. And for, I remember, I think it was 50 cents, when you pop a couple quarters in, you'd slide a beer. You know, at 17 years old, I'm buying beers for 50 cents, you know, I've got it made. I've got it made. And there for, you know, there for a year I did, you know, that year I had it made. Part of my scholarship was because I'd applied to the Naval Academy, and had not been selected for that, but I'd been selected for another program that was paying, so I had to go on a training cruise. So that was my first trip down to San Diego. I was on a destroyer out of Long Beach, 17. Now I'm 18 years old and hanging out with, you know, hardcore sailors on there and then us college kids, us midshipmen. And God, that was, we were in heaven. Took me about a week to find out, 2 weeks, I think, that because they paid us in cash. And so they paid us in cash, and I don't know, whatever I got, my hot $22 or whatever it was, and walked down the companionway. And this guy said, kid, come here. He said, you need all that money? And I said, I'm not entirely dumb. And I said, yeah, I need it. He said, you want to double it? And I said, how do we do that? He said, here's the deal. Because he was collecting, back then it was, I think it was 7 for $5. Or, you know, that was, you know, the, until payday. And he'd stand, and he was a big guy, he'd stand outside the paymaster and collecting for every $5 he loaned out, get $7 back. So I gave him, I don't know, 10 or 15 bucks. And within a month, you know, within that next payday, whatever it was, in 2 weeks, I had some money. So we went to town. We had officers' uniforms on. We weren't officers. We had officers' uniforms on. And in those, I mean, I back to school, my second semester after I went in the fraternity, after being initiated, the next thing you do is take you down to the print shop in Oakland, where you go in the back door and give this guy $5, and he gives you an ID that says you're 21 years old. And though they weren't laminated, they weren't photoed, they were nothing. It just said that, you know, fill in the blank had just turned 21. So, you know, we were set. So I drank pretty much whenever I wanted, whatever I wanted. And I didn't get in a whole lot of trouble. But the thing that hit me there was I was drinking when other people weren't. And this continued the pattern. This continued the pattern. I got kicked out of school the next year because my grades went down, because I drank when other people didn't. I went back home. I went to the junior college, got my grades up, moved back up to the Bay Area, and got a job. I never finished college, but I had enough background that I could get a good job. And went to work for a large company in San Francisco, and things were fine. Excuse me. Got married, moved on, got a better job. You get married, sometimes you know, things work and they don't work, and you have kids, or, you know, and then you, next thing you know, we had 2 kids, and had a better job, and went into sales. And now this was another, I arrived again, a company car and expense account for a guy that likes to drink, moved me to Sacramento and told me that Lake Tahoe and Reno is part of my territory. And we're doing institutional food business with the casinos. I've got every reason, you know, to enjoy this job and to do well at it. And I did for a while, you know, until I didn't. and so before the things, you know, things came down, I moved on to another job, but I made sure that it came with a company car and an expense account. And it was, you know, a little bit more money, and I didn't get to go to Reno and Lake Tahoe anymore, but, you know, it still wasn't bad. And I was selling construction materials to contractors. And so the guy that I worked for, the sales manager up there, he said the thing you do is go out in the morning and take a dozen donuts and they'll really like you. Took me about 2 weeks to figure out that if I went on payday on Friday afternoon with a case of beer, they liked me a whole lot better. And they were more amenable to ordering the stuff from the distributor that I talked about, because we could sit there and drink beer together. You know, it was a heck of a deal. And this was, it was great. Again, there were some constraints here. You know, they want you to do a certain amount of work for that expense account in the company car and sell a certain amount of stuff. So I got to be buddies with one of the contractors, and he said, why don't you come in with me? Because you're good at sales. You can get the jobs. I'll get them done, and we're going to do well. Things were starting to heat up. This was a long time ago. Things were starting to heat up. There were a lot of projects going on. We were doing drywall and painting, and life was good. I mean, man, it was just, we were turning jobs down. We were naming our price. We were making money. We had a ski boat. Folsom Lake was around the corner. You know, we were doing business in the bar. Things were going good until business tailed off and things weren't doing so good. I mentioned that entitlement thing that keeps coming up. So to me, I was entitled to what I figured was my share of the profits. So I was running the checkbook, so I took my share and then maybe some more share of the profits. Now, this was a guy that we were friends, and he thought I was a friend, and I was stealing from him. And so when we figured it out, I thought I'd say, you know, man, I'm sorry, I was stealing from you. Turned out he turned me into the cops. I thought, you know, we're drinking buddies. Why is this happening to me? I'm, you know, the bright and shiny guy. Why is this happening to me? So one of my fraternity brothers was now an attorney up there. So he got me out of it. I got probation, had to pay it back, had to borrow the money from my folks to pay it back. an opportunity came that I'd met a company that supplies with some materials is out of Los Angeles. And for some reason, I impressed them, and they offered me a job in L.A. as a salesman for them. And so it got me away from these people that didn't like me anymore that, you know, tried to send me to jail for taking a couple thousand dollars that weren't mine. So I picked up the family and went to L.A. Worked for that company for several years, and they sent me to Dallas, Texas. Now, I'm in Dallas, Texas, and I've got an office and a warehouse there. I've got a salesman in New Orleans and a warehouse, and I've got a salesman and a warehouse in Houston, Texas. Air, credit card, company car, New Orleans, what could possibly go wrong? What could possibly go wrong? Within 2 years, the wife has packed up and gone back east where she was from, didn't take the picture hangers off the wall, but took virtually everything else. Within 6 months, I'd found a Texas gal and married her, and the company moved me back to L.A. because business was falling apart in Texas. So here I am back again. Now I'm making half as much money. I'm not happy. New wife's not happy. Things aren't good. But I'm still drinking because I like the effect of alcohol, and it makes me feel better when I drink. I don't know how many of you have been evicted from apartments or had cars repossessed. Neither one of those are very fun things. You know, they're not fun things at all. And when your wife at the time doesn't know they're coming and they happen, it's even worse. So my reaction to that was not to man up, not to buck up and say, yeah, and face the music and really get busy, was to run. You know, I ran as hard as I could to the other end of the state where I still had some friends and could go to work for them up there. For another company, again, the same thing. Credit card, company car, the story of my life. I couldn't keep it together. You know, it says in the book that we lose the ability to control our drinking. I wasn't able to control the drinking. The drinking controlled me. That was the only thing that I could do. My only answer was to go back home and crash with mom and dad and try to put something together. And eventually, even that didn't work. You know, again, I had to stand up and say, I need help. I didn't know how to say I need help. People around me said, you need help. You need to stop. You need to at least cut it down. My answer, again, was to run. My brother lived in San Diego. So I took one of mom and dad's cars and ran to San Diego. My brother at the time managed a liquor store while he was finishing school at San Diego State, so it was, you know, kind of nice. I get a discount at the liquor store. And I could pass hot checks there until that caught up with me. And, you know, this was my other MO. I papered the state in bad checks. And but who's going to hire me? You know, I'm a functional drunk. Thank you for asking. I looked pretty good. I could clean up pretty good. And I remember sitting in a bar in Old Town one time and looking at the back bar, like the mirror over there, and looking at myself and had, you know, suit on, had a tie, and didn't have a job, probably didn't have $5, $10 in my pocket, and thinking, Jesus, Dave, you got to do something. You know, you've got to make some changes. And I had done some work in solar work with a company, so I said, well, you know, maybe I can work for somebody selling solar systems down here. And so that was ostensibly what I was doing, went in business for myself. I was independent contractor. And what happened with that is, you know, that was just a story that I told people. That was just a cover that I did. You know, I was in business for myself, but what happened to me, that intervention that I had, was coming out of a bar in somewhere, Kearney Mesa, about 11, 12 in the morning, and was intervened on by the FBI and San Diego Police Department, because it turns out, being an independent contractor, going in and giving tellers notes and saying, give me the cash in the drawer, doesn't qualify as independent contractor, qualifies as a felony, and the federal government frowns on it. So next thing I know, I'm before the judge, and I'm telling him I'm powerless, I've lost the ability to control my drinking. And he said, we're glad you realize you have a problem. We're going to give you 10 years in a federal institution to figure that out. So that's where I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's where I was on March 13th, 1980, after listening to you people, not you in the room, some of you, look like you, came in on the H&I panels and talked about Alcoholics Anonymous. and told me there was another way of living. And so I made that decision that day and haven't had a drink since. I got out after 3.5 years, an early parole, came back to San Diego. One of the guys that had come into the on the H&I panel became my sponsor. He came to see me when I was in the institution, took me to meetings, brought me here early on. Dinners were, I think it went from $4 to $5. They got upset back then. Bill was the director of the Freedom Ranch after a couple of years. There are people in the room that I knew at the Freedom Ranch were on the board. I was on the board of directors at the Freedom Ranch. And, you know, when you come out of prison, you come out with stuff in a cardboard box or a bag or whatever it is. So I was starting over, you know, finally got an apartment, got a car, got a girlfriend, had a cruddy job, and then I got a better job, and I got a better apartment and a better car and, you know, somebody else. And because I also like the effect of having female companionship. So I'm cruising along. I'm on the board of directors of the Freedom Ranch. I'm working for a company in Encinitas, living by the beach. Really got it going on. And they keep giving me more titles and more money at work because I take more responsibility. I love to work. I take it. My problem is, back in these programs that I went through, being in the institution, meeting people from H&I, trying to work that program, I pretty much went from the first step to the 12th step. You know, did I do an inventory? Sort of. Did I make amends? Kinda. It says, you know, that half measures availed us nothing. Not only did they avail me nothing, they caused me more problems because I didn't have that ability to be forthright and honest. Double-digit sobriety. You know, again, I'm looking good. I'm 11, 12 years sober, got a big job, and things start to come apart because I've taken too much on, and I don't have the ability to tell the people I work for and with that I need help, that I can't do it all. And I caused some issues at the company that were big, big problems because of the type of business they were in because I didn't have everything done. I'm engaged to a woman that's in the program. I have no job. I'm 14 years sober. And I don't have, quite frankly, the guts to own up to it again, to raise my hand and say, I need help and I can't do it. Figure that I could figure this thing out myself. The part I don't want to tell you is that I met that FBI team again at 15 years sober. You know, they arrested me with a 15-year token in my pocket. And I remember that one FBI agent looked at me. You know, people looked at me over the years drunk, and when I've done things with it, just look like, what's wrong with you? You know, what's wrong with you? He said, Jesus, you're a great example of AA, aren't you, buddy? He said, you're a great example of AA, aren't you, buddy, when he looked at that. You know, and I couldn't say anything. This time they were not so kind, and the sentence was a little bit longer. I didn't go to the camp fed. I ended up at a camp with a swimming pool and tennis courts, and I ended up at the United States Penitentiary in Lompoc, California, which was called the New Rock when it opened, because that's where they sent the people from Alcatraz when they closed it down. And it was not a pretty place, and I was scared to death. Scared to death. I decided, I mean, not only had I let my friends in AA down, my parents, my brother, my family, you know, everybody. I mean, I couldn't fathom the shame that I was. I couldn't handle it. I didn't know what to do. And I said, I knew what to do. I said, I'll kill myself. Strange as it seems, it was pretty easy to get razor blades in there. And I scoped it out for a week or 2 weeks and saw, you know, how the showers worked and what the schedule was and how I could slip in there and do it. In fact, one guy slid his wrist on the tier across from me while I was thinking about it. And I said, man, I'm going to do that, man. That makes a hell of a mess. I'll do it in the shower. And, you know, I guess, you know, just a gutless wonder. I couldn't do it. It got down to it, and I couldn't do it. I said, you know, on top of whatever else I do, now what are they going to do? Call them, you know, my mom and dad, call my family and say, your son's killed himself in prison? Not that I was, I don't know what I thought I was going to do. A couple days later, there's a notice on the, if there are any correctional officers in here, I don't, you know, we call it the cop shack where the correctional officer was. There was a notice on there that there was an AA convention that Saturday in the library, and I thought, because I hadn't inquired, I didn't know if they had AA meetings, and so I went down to that thing, and there were people there from the outside, and there was a staff member who was in the program that fostered meetings, and he said, yeah, we've got meetings on, you know, Tuesday, Thursday nights, whatever it is down in this unit, you know, you got to sign up because we're locked down, they won't let you out unless you're on the sign-out sheet. So I signed up and went to the meetings. That man that was on the inside has spoken here. He's still my friend today, Lee C. You know, the guys that were in there, the people that came in from the outside, and the men that were in the program at that time saved my life. Many of them have spoken here besides me, have come down from different areas. We have a Zoom meeting every Sunday, and we get together because we don't want to forget where we came and what we went through and what we have to maybe to offer somebody that might be doing the same, living the same way, doing the same things. I was lucky there. We had good meetings ourselves. Lee was the speaker getter for a big meeting in Santa Maria, so we had Earl Hightower, we had Clancy, we had all the big circuit speakers. As a condition, they had to come into the prison on Saturday morning and speak to us before they went to the big meeting on the street. You know, so you know what's that? You know, the joke back then was rob a bank, go to prison, get to hear all the circuit speakers. Go figure. I don't recommend it as a course of treatment, but you know, go figure. We had people that traveled that came down there from groups that did all the Joe and Charlie tapes and the Back to Basics. And that's when I finally, because God knows I had the time, you know, wrote a thorough four step and took a fifth step with a man I'd never seen before, I'll never see again, on the floor of the prison library. I was there for eight years. Got out in 2003. You've heard the story before. I got out with a cardboard box with stuff, books, things. Bring any clothes with you. Came back to San Diego, went to a halfway house, really keen place down on the shipyards, down 28th Street, in Boston, 28th Street. Got a crappy job. And this time, what I did was I said, you know what? I'm calling it a crappy job, but it's not. You know, I lucked out. They didn't check the record thoroughly. I was honest on the application. For whatever the reason, the company needed people. They hired me. You know, so I was straight up. I'll just do the best job that I can for them. And I did, you know, and I started saying, you know, I get to go to work, and I'm happy to have to work on Sunday or whatever it was. I'm happy to work overtime. Didn't make any difference. I really enjoyed doing it. Within a couple of years, I was invited I was working in the warehouse, but they had a program and they said, if you're, you know, any of your employees are over the age of 40, I said, I think I qualify. Any of your employees are over the age of 40 and want to get on this senior recruitment thing because they wanted to get more people of certain age to work for the company in seasonal summer work. So, you know, I raised my hand and said, I'll do it. So I got to go down. I worked up in Mission Gorge in the park. It's a big secret. It's a park with SeaWorld, as a matter of fact, folks. Hope you don't go out of there and say, hey, we know Dave that used to work here. He just spoke down South Bay Pioneers, and guess what, you know? My point is that you know, they invited me down and gave me an opportunity. And a couple of years, and I was working for the employment team. So, you know, I was hiring people like me that came in with a shaky background and was able in some cases to help them, you know, to help them get around it. I tried to be as humble as I could. That's difficult for me. You know, God, it's hard to be humble when you're perfect in every way, but my theme song for so many years, my mantra. But I did try, I really did. And so I got increasingly better jobs and you know, things worked out. And they put me, I was in charge of employee services for the company. And that meant that, you know, I got to do all the fun events for the employees. I was in charge of the courtesy program and did incentives for them. And I remember the first presentation I had to give to a company-wide meeting. It was like 800 people in the auditorium, and I had to bite my tongue to say, you know, I'm Dave from Human Resources, not I'm Dave, I'm an alcoholic, when I got up there. But we got through that all right. And again, as for whatever the reason, seemed to have a gift with handling difficult people. So a couple of things. If you came to the front door to see me, it was probably because it was, you know, something good. You'd won an award, you got some things. On the other hand, if your supervisor brought you to the back door to see me, it was probably not a good thing because you stepped on your toes or you'd gotten, you know, you've gotten out of line in some way, so you needed either some counseling or maybe termination. And so I got to sit across the desk from people that had done the same things that I had done. Not necessarily the drinking, oh, we had a couple of those, but, you know, just had acted out, had been stupid, had just made really bad decisions. And many of them were young enough that I could say, you know, this, you know, man, it's tough, Tommy or Kitty, whatever, Julie, whatever your name is, whatever their name was at the time, but it's an opportunity to learn a lesson. And I said, as far as we're concerned, you worked here for this period of time, and why you left is nobody's business. We don't divulge, you know, unless it was something really bad, we're not going to divulge what it is. So I was there for, retired best part of, after 15 years. And I'm proud to say that I know that I did a good job. I know that I gave them their money's worth. And I know that I had my hands on, I had a safe in my office that had a couple $100,000 worth of zoo tickets and gift cards and, you know, you name it, stuff. And it was all accounted for. It was accounted for every month, and it was accounted for when I left. And you know, I'm happy about that. Happy about that. One of the things I'd never done too much of, I tried to gone back on H&I a couple of times. For some reason, found that a little difficult. There's just something about it that bothers me. So but I said, you know, I this was before I retired. In fact, I said, you know, I need to take a GSR commitment. I haven't been going to meetings in Coronado, so I held my hand up and said, I'll be the GSR for that meeting. And they said, good. You know, you go to the district meeting. And I said, where's that? And they said, it's Imperial Beach. Why? And so somebody in front here is laughing because that's where we met. So, you know, so once a month I'd hike from, you know, I'd haul it from Claremont down to Imperial Beach with the district down there, and enjoyed it. Met some great people, found out about meetings down here that I didn't know about. I said, I remember when dinners went from $4 to $5. That's probably a little bit of an exaggeration, but I came here early on. I remember, you know, when this room wasn't as nice as it is now, when the parking lot didn't have the buildings back there. That's why I said, if you say you're working on it, it'll be here. You know, it may take a couple of years, but that new building will be here. And I've had friends that have gone through the program in the meantime. You know, so I've been here for Sunday meetings and some of the other stuff that goes on. After I retired, I had a little bit more time for service work. And so I volunteered to be a GSR again for the district where I lived, and did that for a couple of years and went to some of these conferences. And the first conference that I went to, I said, they were talking about budgets, or I don't know, God, it just went on forever. And I said, I think this is not, I'm not cut out for this. And a friend said, oh, give it a try, it'll be okay. So I went back for the next one, and I went to the meetings, and I was trying to be diligent. And then they made me treasurer. And I said, do you realize who you're making treasurer? I said, do you see my eyes glow when, you know, when I said, it's there's something in my nature that, you know, that just, yeah, I enjoy the effect that money gives me. And so I was a treasurer for a couple of years, and that was good. And then one night I went to the restroom and came back, and they elected me DCM. So, you know, if you want a commitment, just take a restroom break. You'll know how to catch it. So, again, that was, I'm finding out stuff about AA that I never knew before. You know, I had the opportunity, that was in 2020, just before COVID hit, unfortunately. But the good part is I was able to go to PRASA, to the big conference in Tucson, before everything shut down for COVID. So I got to meet people from all over the Pacific Northwest, the Western states, from Alaska, and to hear about how the program works, where you don't have a meeting, you know, 10 or 12 meetings a day. Thoroughly enjoyed the work that I was able to do, and especially the people that I met. That's the good part. You know, that's why I'm here tonight. Part of the reason I'm here tonight is the guys that, you know, that I met, John and his wife, when we were doing service work. You know, I met this guy at another meeting. I met this guy when we were on the board. You know, just these people were good enough to come four or five zip codes south with me from Claremont. We go to meetings up there. They're people that I've known for 10, 12 years now, and I hope they count me as a friend. I know that I count them as a friend. Because of COVID and the Zoom application, I do, and probably some of you do too, I do meetings all over the world. You know, I'm the secretary, for God's sake, of a meeting out of Cyprus, the island of Cyprus. Now, when they first said this meeting's from Cyprus, I thought they meant Orange County, Cyprus. Then I go on Zoom, and the people are talking with funny accents. They're mostly a couple of Greek Cypriots, mostly English people, you know. So I've learned to say, reading the tradition, say, controversy and things like that. They at their meetings over there, they, in fact, one of the meetings is called the Just for Today meeting. We don't necessarily use it here in Alcoholics Anonymous, so, you know, I didn't bring it to read, but the Just for Today card that they read over there, you know, the things that help me so much to remember that just for today, you know, I can be happy. I've got that choice to make. You know, that just for today, I can be sober. I don't have to pick up a drink. That, you know, just for today, I can mind my own business. You know, I don't have to be offended if somebody doesn't do what I want them to do. That I keep my expectations low today, chances are I'm going to be happier tonight and tomorrow. And just for today, I've got a program. I may not work it perfectly. You know, I've tried to show you how not to do it, because I know I have not worked it perfectly. But I've worked it to the best of my ability. You know, the only thing that I've done perfectly is not drink and not die for 44 years. You know, we can cut to the chase. The rest of it, as I said, is bonus time. And what I choose to make of it, or what you, the folks that are coming in your first 30, 60, 90 days, what I've learned, what you choose to make of it is entirely your decision. Sponsors are wonderful. Fellowship is wonderful. Meetings are great. Speaker meetings are, you know, maybe so-so, whatever it is. But the first 164 pages of the big book tell you what you can do if you want a different way of life. And it's up to you. You know, nobody, that's why I stuck around. If I had gone to that first meeting, I mean, I was locked up, so I it was not the same as being on a street, walking the first street meeting. But if people had said, you need to do this by this date, I would have said, not on your life, buddy. If I was on the street and somebody said, you must go to 90 meetings in 90 days and call me every morning at 7:45, I would have said, something probably not very nice. But you tricked me. What you said was, hey, this is what we did. And you showed me how it was working for you. Now, to be part of that group, son of a gun, you got me. I'm going to have to do some of the things that you did. They're suggested as a program recovery in a book because I want to be part of the crew. And to be part of the crew, you know, it's fine. You can, you know, I can talk the talk, but you also at some point have to be able to walk the walk. And for me, I learned that, you know, what it talks about in the next paragraph is that psychic change that we go through. Whether it's a spiritual awakening, a psychic change, whatever it is, I just know that some point in my life it clicked. And I knew that I couldn't do this by myself. And that if I realized that something somewhere, George Burns is God, or, you know, anything, whatever it is, you know, this pine tree, I don't care. Something somewhere had kept me sober and reasonably sane and gave me an opportunity to lead a genuine life, then I'd had that psychic change. I mean, I had a spiritual awakening smoking PCP years ago. So I know what a blinding white light is. I didn't want that again. I wanted the educational variety, and that's what I've gotten in this program. And part of that is being able to come out and share a little bit of with you folks on a Saturday night. You know, I mean, you know, God, we could be in Tijuana, right? You know, and how many times? But, you know, I choose to be here, and chicken fried steak is my favorite, and so for that, I thank you.
Oh, man, that was great. Dave, thank you very much for sharing your story with us. Please, please come back again and do it again. One more time for Dave. Thank you to the ladies auxiliary and the men of the house for a wonderful dinner. Don't forget to donate to Charm's house. Let's circle up.